There is an open seat for Congress right here in Los Angeles, and we are talking with the candidates who want to represent you on Capitol Hill. Our special guest is Mike Feuer on this episode of What's Next, Los Angeles. Several months ago, Congressman Adam Schiff announced he was running for the United States Senate. That created a rare vacancy in a district that he has represented for 20 years. It is an open race to represent a huge, sprawling district that stretches from Sunland to Hunga to Glendale and Burbank to Hollywood and West Hollywood. There is a large field of candidates, and we are on What's Next Los Angeles talking to as many of them as possible and hearing from them and giving them an opportunity to talk to you. Today, I am very grateful to have joining me Mike Feuer. Mike served for 9.5 years as Los Angeles City Attorney. Before that, he served in the California State Assembly and the Los Angeles City Council. He has gained a reputation as someone who has focused intently on gun control and consumer protection and environmental protection and other issues. I should note, I have known Mike since 1996 or 97. When I was a wee lad at City Hall and he was on the City Council, and have had the opportunity to work together with him in all three of his elected capacities. Mike, thanks for joining me.
So I said, I think we were both wee lads in those days.
Yeah, this is true. Yeah. But the mustache was always there.
That's right. I haven't shaved my mustache for many years.
Yep. So I start these out by giving every candidate an opportunity to just give their pitch, their sort of elevator pitch to a voter. Who are you and why are you running for Congress?
Thanks very much, Mike. I mean, this is about the most urgent moment that I can remember we've had in our world, in our nation, and certainly on Capitol Hill. I am running to make a transformative difference, to bring idealism and a record of accomplishment on the major issues we face to Washington. This is not a time to run simply to be in office or to vote. Any of the candidates on the Democratic side who's running is going to vote more or less the same way. I'm running to lead, as I always have. I'm running to bring the kind of aspirational politics that I think we are all looking for right now, that inspires people to believe that we can be better, to lift people up, and to be, as I said, transformative with big, bold ideas. I've had a record of envisioning what could be and then changing that vision into reality again and again. This is a time for us to be listening more carefully to each other and bringing out the best in each other. I think most people are looking for politics that is optimistic and transformative, and that's what I intend to bring to Capitol Hill.
What would you say are the experiences that have best prepared you to represent a 500,000 residents of the 30th District?
Most of my public service career would be in that category. And, you know, my career began, we didn't discuss this, my career began not in elective office, but in service when I was the director of Betsedik Legal Services. For our listeners, Betsedik means House of Justice. It's an organization that is among the leading public interest law firms in the United States, providing free legal assistance to people in desperate need. You know, seniors who are losing their health care, folks who are losing their houses or being unlawfully evicted, people being ripped off in consumer scams or being abused or neglected in nursing homes. We helped 50,000 clients when I led that organization before I ran for office. And I found that work to be the first real opportunity I had had to day in, day out, come to the office and realize that people's lives depended on my leadership and we could affect them in meaningful ways. And one of the legal newspapers wrote that I made Betsedik a national success story. And it inspired me to run for office because the next thing I did was to run for city council against people who were much more famous than I. I took a big risk. You know, I've been running Betsedik for 8 years. Wife and I had a couple kids. We were both public interest lawyers. I quit my job and walked door to door. And it worked out. And on the city council where we met each other, that was, I think, the first experience that provided me some background that would help me in this race for Congress now. Because you'll recall, I took on issues sometimes other people were less inclined to want to take on, tough issues. Everything from gun violence to marriage equality at a time when people were not supporting marriage equality.
That's true.
And, you know, and on gun violence issues, a good example of my approach to things, I ended up writing most of the city's toughest laws on gun violence, but also working beyond what any legislator was anticipated to do. I worked with a nonprofit organization, Women Against Gun Violence, to create a working group of cities all throughout Southern California to collaborate when the state wasn't taking action, so we would have common rules in our area and defeat the NRA approach that said, well, you know, we can just cross the border of a city and get around your laws. I also looked around corners in ways that people can see and touch and feel. For example, in those days, you'll recall that there were dozens, more than 100 phone numbers to get access to basic city services, and 911 was much too slow because people were calling the emergency number for non-emergencies. And I spearheaded the creation of what was called 311, a change in city services, and it required one to really dig in. That was not a press conference moment. That was years of changing the very way service was delivered in Los Angeles. And, you know, those kinds of moments made me realize that it is one thing to do the tweet or the press conference, another to say the big issues require really digging your heels in and making sure that you could inspire the idea and get folks to vote for it and then work to implement it. And Mike, by the way, there's something else I learned as a city council member, and that was, to my surprise, when I got to the council, as you know, I was a kid. I was half the age of some of my council colleagues. And there was a piece on the front page of LA Times, the title of which was something like Fewer Causes Furor on City Council Floor. And, you know, the essence of the piece was, here is a new member who's very young, who is making consequential things happen right away. And some of my senior colleagues were kind of bristling at the idea that I was not being, you know, seen and not heard, but actually taking leadership. And I learned very quickly that if one displays real horsepower, that you can articulate a vision for what could be, you can have a depth standing of the issue and you're sure you can do it, people back off and defer to you. Like on the gun violence issue, in the wake of some horrible shootings here in the city of North Valley Jewish Community Center shooting, people essentially deferred, and I was able to get a lot of things passed. And that was a real lesson for me. And I took that to the state legislature, another great place for a background for running for Congress, where I was appointed the majority leader for policy for the California Assembly. I chaired the Judiciary Committee. And again, at a very tough time, hyper-partisan time in Sacramento, the Great Recession was causing tremendous pain. It was a very tough time to govern. I was nonetheless able to take the lead on huge, important measures on environmental protection, on toxics, on gun violence, as you mentioned, on healthcare. You know, that was a time before the Affordable Care Act when kids with pre-existing conditions were not insured. And I wrote the law that required those kids get insurance before the Affordable Care Act. Those kinds of actions, again, led me to realize how much one person can do to make a difference. And as city attorney, you'll recall a chapter when both you and I had a role in this. When Trump took office, this became a defining moment. I mean, I was working nationally on gun violence issues. We can talk more about that. The Obama White House had me come speak to leaders across the United States at the White House about how to be a leader on guns, for example. But when Trump took office, there was a whole new dimension to leadership. And the day that the Muslim travel ban took effect, you know, I spent hours that night till almost midnight at the airport to try to get the detainees released. And when after a tremendously, it was like a movie set to be there, a tremendously emotional and difficult period, I was not able to convince the top Trump official to let the detainees leave. But just a few hours later, that Sunday morning, I called my chief of staff. We had lawyers in my office ready to sue the Trump administration, which we did effectively again and again, either on our own or in coalition with cities and counties across the United States, and everything from public safety to DACA to the census. And all these experiences combined create, I think, the following for me. One, there is no question that one runs for office, not to be in office, but to accomplish big things. Two, that one person can make a major difference at every level of government. Three, in a very partisan legislative environment, I found a way both to accomplish transformative change And even though we disagreed 90% of the time, to find moments when I could work with people on the other side of the aisle, because listening is a very undervalued skill in public service. So these experiences in this race, I have by far the most depth and breadth on every issue in this race. But it's about more than the past. This race is about the future. Building on that experience, I want to identify the big issues. And the last thing I'll say, Mike, is this. You know, people run for state and federal office and often get detached from the work in the community that elected them. When Mayor Bass endorsed me in this race for Congress, she said, I need a partner in Washington on homelessness and affordable housing. And I would have chosen a different word. I would have said a champion. I want in Washington to be the go-to person on Capitol Hill for our region and for beyond that when it comes not only to resources for homelessness and affordable housing, but also changing rules. Like, as you know, the cap on Medicaid reimbursement for mental health, building mental health facilities, has inhibited us from doing the work we need to do here.
Yep.
Anyway, a lot of stuff that leads me to be effective as I move to this next role in Congress.
I remember that day in January of 2017 at the airport. There were massive protests outside. I was in office, but I was part of the protests and real confusion and human misery at people trying to get through customs. And I remember you there. You were there. Absolutely. Working hard on that. And I remember texting you later in the night. You were working very hard on that.
Actually, Mike, before we go on, let me just, so our listeners understand what life is really like. So that night, I tried to go find the detainees, and I was stopped by law enforcement on the ramps that lead to them, saying I had no jurisdiction there. And finally, after maybe three or four, I got 11:30 at night, the Trump official there deigned to see me. But in the meantime, the chants, you'll recall, were "let them out." But yep. Then the crowd recognized me and the chants changed to "let Mike in." And it was actually very frustrating for me because I didn't have an army with me to march past the law enforcement there. And then one of the protesters beckoned me over in the middle of the night and to talk to her behind the barricade. And she said, my dad has Parkinson's disease. He does not have his medication and he is being detained. You need to help him. And what I just wanted to say is, finally, when I wasn't going anywhere, and the Trump official said, I'll meet you halfway down those ramps, 11:30 at night. So we have a conversation and this is how it really went. I said, where are the detainees? I can't tell you. How many are there? Not at liberty to say. I said, you know, there'd been a court order issued a few hours earlier on the East Coast banning the deportation of the detainees. Are you honoring it? He said, I can't tell you that either. And at that point, I've never been angrier as a public official. I said to him the story of the woman's dad. And I will concede that I was a little self-righteous about it because I was so angry. I said to him, the Constitution matters to her father right now. And he said to me, I have an airport to run. And that led to my calling my chief of staff near midnight to get lawyers in the office the next day. But that is how that evening really went. It was very dramatic. And, you know, I didn't succeed that night at getting the detainees released, but a lot of success followed from that. Anyway, sorry for that digression. It just sometimes we talk in generalities and people should hear kind of what really happens.
Yeah, no, that was a very powerful defining moment for the country. You talked about a lot of the issues you've worked on in the city, in both offices and in Sacramento. What would you consider to be your most significant achievement?
That's a good question, because fortunately, there are a lot of them. I mean, let's talk about the gun violence issue just for a second.
Sure.
So, I'll say this much typifies my approach to stuff. So when I became city attorney, I had learned as a member of the state legislature that Democrats on the floor listened to maybe the Sierra Club, Republicans to the Chamber of Commerce, perhaps. But everybody cared what prosecutors thought. And one of my many roles as city attorney was to be the prosecutor for the city. So I reached out to the DA of Manhattan, who was then Cyrus Vance Jr. I met him once. And I said, you know, we should form the nation's first ever coalition of prosecutors focused on preventing gun violence, because we might have some street cred with both sides of the aisle. And he said, sure, let's do it. And that became Prosecutors Against Gun Violence. We've had a very impactful role. I mentioned I was asked to speak at the White House in that role. And I'll tell you, we focused on things that really matter to people. For example, as you probably know, when there's a gun in the equation and domestic abuse is happening, the woman is 500% more likely to get killed than if there's not a gun there. So one of the first things our national team did was write a blueprint for how every state in the nation could disarm domestic abusers, and different for different states. And the Obama White House tweeted our report across the nation. We did a lot of consequential work. But then in the middle of all this, Parkland happened. And again, I want to talk in real terms to our listeners. So in the Parkland tragedy happens, and I bring our group to Capitol Hill, thinking this is a moment when we can be a catalyst for bipartisan action on gun violence in the wake of the Parkland tragedy. And we held a press conference. And to give you a sense, you know, we had senators there, we had members of the House, the Parkland kids. And for a moment, I thought Lindsey Graham was going to show up because we invited him and he said he was going to come. And I thought, this is why we're here. But this is what I want to say. So we do this for international presses there. And one of the Parkland kids in particular stood out to me. She spoke in a way that encapsulates why we do this work. She said, I was in my Holocaust studies class when the shooting started, and my friend Nicholas across the aisle fell to the ground. I was really confused. This girl was 16 at the time, didn't know what was going on. Then I realized people were getting shot. And so she fell to the ground too, she said, to mimic Nicholas's situation, thinking that might save her life. But the gunfire continued. And so she pulled Nicholas's dead body over hers to protect herself from the gunfire. And this girl is telling us the story. Her mother is nearby. Tears are streaming down her cheeks when the girl says, I then had to apologize to Nicholas's parents, who said, you did nothing wrong. Gun violence is often talked about as a partisan issue, as a bunch of numbers. That is not what this is about. This is about people's lives. This young girl is going to have trauma for the rest of her life from this incident, let alone the people who lost their lives in this incident. So I've been very proud. As you know, I've written tons of laws on this issue, been able to have a national impact, and worked on some things that I'm not sure you know about. For example, as city attorney, one of the issues that I think is the most under-discussed things in our society is the impact of trauma on young brains. And there's been a lot of recent research. When I was on the city council, I was a leader in getting therapists to roll out with police to the scenes of domestic violence calls when kids were there, because the science then, you remember, was that kids are more likely to perpetrate violence when their victims are witnesses of it. But the brain science has evolved a lot, Mike, since then. So now it's those kids will never have their brains develop the way they were biologically destined to if they are exposed to trauma from guns, from gangs, from DV in their homes. And as city attorney, I wanted to find a way to address what is a problem that confronts the same kids who have the least access to healthcare, the least access to education, the least access to recreation and decent food, often single family parents. All this is happening at the same time for these kids. And so I formed a program, our Kids Exposed to Violence program, and we've gotten national grants in the city attorney's office right before I left. Tremendous work, where now I wanted to find where shots fired calls were most prevalent. It's a reporting district in Watts. We began by sending teams of LAPD, a trained therapist from the Children's Institute, and a community activist to the scene looking for kids and parents where we know kids even knew the shot was fired, and then offering immediate therapy to those kids, and then training administrators and teachers and parents at their schools what the signs of trauma would be so intervention can happen before these kids are irrevocably damaged. And now we're on to something, because as you might know, this is now a national phenomenon. One of the summits that gun violence group I helped form held was nationally focused on this particular issue. So there are many facets to gun violence, from writing laws to being a catalyst for change by at other levels of government, to also identifying issues that really matter on the street to kids right now. And, you know, I've done a lot of stuff I'm very proud of. This is among the things I'm proudest of, in part because it's way beyond the scope of what a city attorney's job is. And for that matter, what I did nationally was beyond the scope of what a member of the legislature does, because we need right now to far transcend what folks expect of us. The crises, from the climate crisis to the matter of reproductive choice, to what's happening to trans kids across the country, to the economy, all of these issues call on us to do more than we've ever done.
You've talked about immigration, and you've talked about gun violence with very personal stories. Those are very moving personal stories. People sometimes don't think of candidates or elected officials as actual real people who have real lives and real stories themselves. I'm wondering if there's a personal experience in your life that has shaped the way you view public service.
Great question. I'll mention two. So one has to do with why I chose public service in the first place. When I was in high school, as you know, I'm an athlete, I was pitching to my dad. My dad was a public school educator as a professional and volunteer for 60 years. And my dad, I was maybe a sophomore in high school or something. And if I was really pitching well, my dad's left hand would be beat red from even though I had a mitt on afterwards. And I'm throwing hard to him. And I said, why'd you choose your job? And my dad told me in more detail than he did before what it was like to be a prisoner of war to the Nazis in World War II. You know, my dad had been a turret gunner in a B-24 bomber. He'd enlisted in World War II in the Army Air Corps because the word of the Holocaust had gotten to this country. He wanted to fight the Nazis. And he was in a little ball turret, which is a little glass ball beneath the belly of a B-24. And his job was to defend the plane against oncoming Nazi fighter pilots. And the plane was shot down. And Mike, think about the fact, you know, you have a son. Think about the fact my dad was maybe 20, 21 when this is happening, right? And the plane is shot down. And the plane's going down. My dad's telling me you can't get out of that turret unless someone inside the plane has a presence of mind to turn it around from the inside. You can squeeze back into the plane. Someone does that, and he jumps from the airplane. I'll tell our listeners a very funny little anecdote. That's not the point of the story. My dad never parachuted before. The Army Air Corps never trained him. So he pulls the ripcord, and a small chute, which is what happens, I guess, emerged from the parachute. And my dad said, oh, my God, I have a kid's parachute. And then the bigger chute emerged, and it got very serious very quickly because he was captured immediately in a hail of gunfire by the Nazis and taken to Stalag 17. You know, they made a very famous movie about Stalag 17. At the end of the war, I'm going to omit a lot of the texture of this, but it's a very important story to me. At the end of the war, the Russians are coming to liberate the camp, and my dad cannot walk because he'd injured himself when he fell too hard on when he parachuted, and the Nazis wouldn't give him boots that fit. And his buddies wanted to carry him on the march the Nazis intended from Stalag 17 across Austria in the snow. And my dad was not going to burden his buddies that way. And so he said he created a little tiny wooden cart that he held onto for stability, and a guard with a German Shepherd and a gun accompanied him. My dad said it was a miracle he didn't shoot me because we were so far behind the rest of my guys, no one would have heard the sound from the shot had he killed me. And my dad said to me, when I survived what I thought I would not survive that march, I decided to do the most important work in the world. And my dad was a really brilliant guy, could make a lot of money. But for him, the important work, having seen World War II, was kids. So he said, I became a teacher and then a school principal because kids were the thing that mattered most. And in retrospect, years later, I realized he was not merely answering my question about why he chose his job. He was indicating what criterion is I should choose for mine, right?
Yeah,
and,
sure.
And so that's a very formative thing for me. From that age, I was committed to finding ways to change the world for people. And just really quickly, the other formative experience much later in life was when I was running for city attorney. Because you might remember about a decade ago, I was in a horrible car accident. It's usually a fatal accident. A truck ran a red light and hit me right where I sit in my little Toyota Prius at the time. And when a truck hits you on the left, the Prius has a console on the right. So there's no place for your body to go. And the entire left side of me was creamed. I had 6 broken ribs and my lung collapsed. A lot of terrible things happened. And I realized how lucky I was to survive an experience that I had a lawyer help me with the insurance. She said, I have a client just like you. I work for the decedent's family. And, you know, it cemented for me how short life can be and how it can turn on a dime. And you know me to be a pretty intense person. I have a sense of urgency about the work I do. And the combination of my father's admonition to find the most important work and my own experience with how close you can be every moment to not being around anymore means you got to burn really brightly in this little tiny moment we have to change the world for other people. And that's, you know, all I care about basically are my family and that.
Thanks for sharing that. Your dad sounds like a remarkable guy, and that was a remarkable story.
Yeah, you know, I've met your parents, of course, who are so proud of you.
Right.
But my dad, you know, passed away 7 years ago now. And, you know, but he was a volunteer in public schools here almost until he died at 92. I mean, wow. An incredible thing. Steve Lopez wrote a column about him, actually. Steve, you know, is kind of a cynical guy. The photographer, mm-hmm. after he saw my dad in action with young kids, my dad went to public. This is actually indicative of my approach to the world, too. My dad's thing as a volunteer was to go into public schools and hold these sessions with fourth and fifth graders, kind of ethics for small people. So what do you do when your friend is cheating on the test and asks you to cheat too? Or your buddy's being bullied on the playground and you're scared of the bully yourself? Or your dad is hitting your mom and you have no place to go? What do you do? My dad would have those sessions with these kids and they would jump out of their skin to participate. It was wonderful to see this diverse array of kids begging to participate in what were really important sessions about how life should be. And Lopez's photographer said to me afterwards, kind of emotionally, it was such an honor to be able to photograph your dad. So yeah, no, he was a wonderful person. And if I can live up to a little tiny bit of his example, I'll be doing okay.
I will track down the Lopez column, and I will put a link to it in the show notes.
Great.
So people can read that. I want to ask a couple questions about the district. The 30th district is pretty diverse. There's a big difference politically, say, from Burbank and Pasadena on one end and Echo Park and Fairfax on the other. Curious, how do you go about representing Glendale homeowners and West Hollywood progressives?
Yeah. Well, you know, you asked earlier about how my experiences previously have prepared me for this job. You could have asked that about my city council district as well, right? Because I represented, Sherman Oaks homeowners and the folks in Valley Glen. And I represented people in the Fairfax area and Beverlywood, very often very different perspectives on issues. And the answer is this. You know, I have a very strong set of core values and a deep commitment to effectuating those values in the work I do. But I said earlier, I also think that listening is just crucial in politics. And I think it's really important to listen to what your constituents are asking. Having said that, there are common issues that I am sure will bring people together. I mentioned, for example, the importance of focusing on homelessness in Congress. There has not been, as you know, there has not been nearly enough effort on Capitol Hill to grapple with homelessness. It's not that resources alone can help us here. It's not that rule changes alone can help us here. But why the hell is it that we need to seek a waiver from federal rules that preclude building a facility of more than 16 beds of mental health beds? There shouldn't be a rule from which to seek the waiver in the first place. And that requires real tenacity. The Republicans now are trying to defund HUD's efforts to provide more vouchers, housing vouchers here. We got to have people who focus on that. There's not a soul in the district that I can imagine who would dispute the importance of my leadership on those two issues. And so one finds issues around which to unify people. There'll be some things, Mike, where we disagree with, where I disagree with some of my constituents. For example, I have a record of which I'm extremely proud on leading on reproductive choice. Not just voting, but reaching out to Planned Parenthood and saying, hey, can you help me with a law that I think would be helpful here in Los Angeles to protect women? So there'll be some people who are anti-choice in my district. I will not find common ground with them on that issue. But they, I hope, will respect me for standing up for principles that I make very clear as I'm running for office. But otherwise, there'll be a lot of common ground issues, I think, to explore, as I mentioned. You know, from West Hollywood to Burbank, there are going to be folks who say what is happening with trans kids across the country is despicable. And there's got to be national leadership to assure that kids who are among the most vulnerable people in our society aren't being picked on for crude political gain. What are you going to do about it? You know, and I think that national legislation to protect them is a good place to start. So I'll be looking for the common ground wherever I can. I'll be very acutely listening to what people want the most from their elected officials. I'm also going to be committed to attaching what happens in D.C. to making lives better on the streets here. That'll be a good formula. That's worked for me before.
Where do you live and how long have you been in the district?
I live in the Fairfax area. We've lived there for 18 years. So the district has evolved over the course of time. And now we're kind of in the center of it or a third of it. One of the advantages of my candidacy is that I've represented more people in the district than any of my competitors have. So I have a good feeling because from the state legislature to the city council to my work as city attorney. And that'll be really helpful because, you know, I've been to every neighborhood in Los Angeles. So it's been very important to do that. And I'm going to be I've been in Glendale and the Burbank area a lot. I think that continuing to do that will be very helpful as I run.
The demographics of the district are interesting. It's arguably the most important Armenian district in the country. It includes the first gay city, the first city with an LGBTQ majority council. Large Russian immigrant community, large Jewish community, increasing Latino population. How do you think the unique demographics of the district will impact how you lead and the issues you choose to lead on in Congress?
Well, for one thing, I need to be, you know, Adam Schiff has, sometimes kiddingly, been referred to as an honorary member of the Armenian community. And I have spent a lot of time focused on issues of the Armenian genocide and trying to teach the lessons from that genocide. And also, there are important foreign policy issues pending now. There's an area called the Gorno-Karabakh that Armenian community calls Artsakh between Azerbaijan and Armenia that has been a location where there have been horrific acts perpetrated by the Azeris with regard to the Armenians. I need to be the leader on Capitol Hill on those issues, because there's no district in the country with a higher concentration of Armenian Americans than this one. It's also the case that, and this would be true whether represented West Hollywood or other places or not, we've discussed earlier in passing my commitment to LGBTQ rights. This has been a longstanding passion of mine. There is not a candidate in this race who can come close to my record, not of voting, but on leading on these issues. From marriage equality to anti-discrimination measures, and sometimes taking positions that were tough to take. When I was on the city council, you recall, I led the effort to preclude the Boy Scouts from using city facilities because they discriminated against gay and lesbian kids. And I think that the district is going to come to respect that brand of leadership. I also need, we mentioned immigration issues. When I was city attorney, we joined and were leaders in the country on DACA and temporary protective status. There are going to be the Latino population of the district going to include people who care about those issues. I'm going to be front and center on those issues, issues in the Middle East. There's a meaningful Jewish population in the district. I have a lot of expertise on Middle Eastern issues. As a state legislator, I led efforts to curtail Iran's aspirations to get nuclear weapons by precluding the state from investing in Iran's energy sector, and did work in the city in the same way. So there are lots of different niches, lots of different aspects of life in the district that require a representative who is astute about all of them and has enough depth to be a leader on each of them.
The district also has some of the biggest entertainment and cultural influences in the world. It includes Disney Studios and Paramount Studios, Warner Brothers Studios, Universal Studios Hollywood. With all the jobs that the entertainment sector provides, I assume the rep for this area generally feels a special obligation to look out for the entertainment industry in Washington. Yeah. But there's a big strike underway right now, and all of those locations I just mentioned have had picketers outside them for the past several weeks. How do you see your role as the representative of, you know, what is the entertainment capital of the world?
It's a great question. And I've been among the picketers on the line with writers who, if our listeners aren't aware of this, are striving to survive because the impact of streaming on their daily lives has been incredibly detrimental, and they're trying to find a way to get a fair wage. But I will say, Mike, I think it's really important, once we get past this strike, it is, in fact, essential that I be a leader for the entertainment community. And there are key issues that are pending in Congress. For example, the issue of piracy is a tremendously important issue in the entertainment industry. And just as for writers, the issue of their pay with streaming is an existential issue. For the industry, piracy continues to be among those key issues. And as you know, there are some splits. Some of the as we go into the digital economy, some of the digital companies and the entertainment companies differ about how to help grapple with these issues. I have to be very keenly involved with that. And, you know, there are other issues, Mike, that are very extremely complex, where this district is going to want somebody who can rise to the occasion. Take the impact of AI, artificial intelligence, on all our lives, but certainly on the entertainment industry. It's an issue right now in the writer's strike. It's going to be an issue for all of us. Earlier on in this race, a few months ago, I publicly stated a statement about the importance of putting the brakes on some of the AI evolution until we can have guardrails in place to really understand the impacts on jobs, on the way kids deal with school, on the way we think, and on elections, because we know that Russian bots have tried to make a huge impact on domestic politics here. So anyway, Mike, yes, bottom line is big place, a very important place to be. And this conversation really underscores the breadth of a job. You know, a lot of, let's be real. The people listening to this podcast now, in the main, have very little faith in the quality and integrity of elected officials. They doubt the efficacy of people going to Congress, and they're wondering why anybody would do it right now. That's where people are coming from.
That's true.
And I get that. But as I've explained in this discussion, that's exactly when we need the best of us to be focused on these issues and really have a command of these issues and try to move on them. Because I think one of the reasons people are so turned off to politics is they see too little action in the face of crises that affect their daily lives. I get it.
I want to get a sense of what type of congressman you think you would be. The Los Angeles area has a lot of different personalities in Congress. Our congressional reps have different styles, temperaments, philosophies. Adam Schiff was seen as sober, cerebral, and moderate, and was very popular in the district. How would you say you compare or contrast yourself with him in terms of style and political philosophy?
Fair enough. So it's interesting because Adam would, by the way, would take issue with what you just said, right? Adam, as he runs for Senate, has said, "I'm a progressive who gets things done." Just saying.
He wouldn't question the cerebral or sober, though.
Well, no,
I imagine.
That's true. But I make that point, though, because I will be a progressive leader in the House who gets things done. That's been my career. We haven't even discussed. There's a wide array of issues where I have one achievement after another because I think it's essential that we don't just talk. Politicians talk. You got to be able to act. So I'm going to be known as someone who can inspire, someone who is a catalyst for major change, someone who understands in-depth issues so colleagues respect him on the floor and ideally defer. I need to be able to earn enough respect to get key committee assignments and be in a position to affect the change I want. For example, if I want to be a leader on homelessness, I get to get on housing and banking, for example, and other committees will give me an opportunity to exercise some muscle and get those things done. I think the electorate will see me as someone who is at bottom impactful, someone who's making a major mark. And ideally, someone who even in this atmosphere is known for not only having strong ideals, but also finding common ground where we can. You know, when I was in Sacramento, I was in the leading on gun violence and LGBTQ issues and environmental justice. And at the same time, I wanted to have a bill in this is maybe a little more than a decade ago, where that said that nursing homes were required to post their quality of care ratings, because I knew from my work at Betsedic that people are in desperate straits when they look for nursing homes for loved ones and they can't compare quality. So I went to a Republican member in this very starkly partisan moment, Cameron Smythe, Santa Clarita, and said, you know, I can do this bill by myself, but let's do it together just to show we can do it together. Because I thought that was important. And we did. And the bill got passed and it's law now. So I think that voters are going to see me as someone who stands up for what he believes in, but also as someone who's respected on both sides of the aisle as a listener. Because, Mike, you know, one thing, just really quickly, I was listening to a member of Congress from this district about 2 weeks ago. There was a screening of a movie about the Tree of Life shooting, which was the shooting at the synagogue in Pittsburgh. And this member was saying in the panel discussion afterwards, I was dispatched by House leadership, she's a Democrat, to go talk to Republicans and just say, what do you want? You can't be happy with the status quo. I'm paraphrasing a little. But she was saying what a revelation it was. People were like taken aback. You really want to know what I think? And I think that I'm the kind of guy who will be seen as doing that a lot, even with people with whom I might disagree most of the time, because I think there's something so corrosive about, you know, the divisions in our nation are mirrored in divisions on Capitol Hill, and they kind of ping pong against each other. The division on Capitol Hill poison our nation. And I think I don't think people understand how possible it is to have strong convictions and yet be someone who treats people with respect, whether you agree or not.
So you set me up so well. That was such a great segue for my next question. Recently, Congressman Robert Garcia was speaking. It was at the Stonewall Democrats event where I saw you last month. He was talking about bipartisanship, and he later followed it up in some public statements. And he said, quote, if we spend our time compromising with the extreme right, we won't have a democracy in 10 years. And he was talking about how that's all that's left on the Republican side of the aisle in Congress. Basically, it sounded as if he was saying that bipartisanship in Congress right now isn't possible. But it sounds like you believe it is.
Well, a couple of thoughts. First of all, I don't think we should compromise on principle. You know, if someone were to say, let's get some bipartisan compromise to diminish the rights of people of immigrants or LGBTQ people, I would say talk to somebody else. That's ridiculous. I think that there is, and Robert is somebody I respect a lot. So let me speak in more general, not as much about his comment, but in general terms. I think that there is a deep misunderstanding sometimes between the notions on the one hand of compromising on principle, which you should never do in my view, and compromising on interests, which is the heart of what it is to be an effective elector. And there's an art to that, maintaining your principles, but finding ways to find common ground on things. And I think a few other things. Now, he is there and I am not. So it is easy for me to say this from this perch. But I remember, again, when I served in Sacramento, the Great Recession was underway and it was partisan as can be. And I have to tell you that I can't disagree more with the idea that you can't find, as I mentioned with my Cameron Smythe, you can't find people to find common ground on something. Now, things have gotten pretty bad on Capitol Hill right now. But let's take an example. There are those representatives from New York who shouldn't be there. They are Republicans representing districts that Biden won, and they don't belong there. And ideally, they will not be there in the future. But their constituents don't want extremism. Their constituents don't want election denial. Their constituents don't want to tear us apart. They're looking for decent education and safe streets, and they want to look after their kids. They want some normalcy in their lives. That's why they were Biden voters. There are people representing districts like that across the aisle with whom one can find some common ground on some things. Now, at this moment, I'm deeply disappointed that those folks went along with the, we're in the middle of this debt ceiling debate as this is being taped tonight. And they all signed on to the Republican bill, which is a very extreme bill. But they also said things like, if I thought that was going to be the law, I would never have voted for it. It was a strategy. So I respect Robert a great deal. He knows more than I do about the interactions on the Hill at the moment. But I always think that there's an opportunity that the Republican Party has been taken over by Trump. But not everybody in the party has been taken over. Just look at what's happening in the presidential primaries right now. You know, no longer are people just backing off. You're seeing a number of Republicans running, no longer scared to death about the idea of challenging Trump. Because there is a faction of the Republican Party looking for normalcy. And I just think that we can find some of that without compromising a moment of conviction.
Let me hit a couple issues. I want to talk about climate change to start. Report after report keep coming out saying that we are passing dangerous temperature thresholds, pushing the planet past the point of catastrophic warming, and we're sort of locking ourselves in cycles that can't be reversed. And every time there's a warning and it gives us a deadline, best case scenario, it doesn't seem like the federal government is moving us to meet those goals. What do you think our best case scenario is to confront the climate crisis, and what role would you play in getting us there?
Well, first of all, I have to say, our kids and grandkids are going to look at us and say, what the hell were you doing when we had a chance to save the planet and you were moving in this minor incremental way? This is not, I never say climate change. That's much too innocuous a way to put it. It's a climate crisis. It's a climate emergency. And those of us who have some depth on this issue need to step up and push the ball forward as hard as we possibly can. I cannot say this strongly enough. The signature, everything else practically, no matter how dire it is, we can grapple with over time. If we don't deal with this right now, there will be nothing else. And I am incredibly impatient with the pace of things. Now, you know, I think the president has done a good job at getting what he could in the infrastructure bill, and that's a great start. But we got to be moving at rocket speed. Because as you said, the most recent reports are in 5 years, we're going to exceed 1.5 Celsius increase, right? So I know that sounds a little technical, but let's put it this way. The point of no return. Mm-hmm. And the thing I would say, Mike, is I don't see signs of this now, but I am hopeful that the gravity of the crisis and the speed with which it is coming is going to start to change people's minds about the pace with which we're moving, which is too damn slow. Now, a couple of things. In Congress, I want to be consequential. I've said this before. We have to be grappling with carbon capture and methane and hydrogen hubs and energy storage. There are a bunch of opportunities that give the lie to the notion that it's either a good economy and good jobs, or we grapple with the climate crisis. Mm-hmm. And here in Los Angeles, we are poised to have our economy just take off if we take advantage of what a new economy based on clean energy could yield here. And so you're going to see me in the midst of this. Now, your question was, you know, what do I think will we pass a moment of no return? Maybe. If we don't, I will tell you this. The thing about Trump's service isn't that he was just such a incredibly corrosive figure in every level, but we lost 4 years on the climate that we're never getting back. And so there's a sense of urgency about the next presidential campaign, about whether Congress is going to return to being democratically controlled or not, because apparently the only folks caring about this are on our side. But having said that, one quick footnote, I was talking to a Congress member about 10 years ago who was the leader of the then Democratic Caucus on Climate. And I said to him, what about evangelicals and insurance companies? isn't there some way to tether our aspirations for moving fast on the climate to, for example, the imperative that your insurance companies fund Republicans? And my point was, they are going to confront, and now we're seeing this happening in real time, billions of losses. They should be putting pressure for action, too. And one of the things you're going to see me on the climate is to try to find those interest groups that are not typically thought of as being aligned with us on trying to move forward on the climate, because there are big moneyed interests right now who are going to get creamed if we don't do something immediately. And so I'm going to be working with scientists, with business, with politicians, and I'm going to be a key leader on this issue. As you can tell, it's a very strong passion of mine.
You've mentioned homelessness a few times.
Yeah.
It is the issue that is on the minds of everybody in Los Angeles. What role do you think the federal government needs to be playing, and what sort of legislation would you be working on to get us there?
Well, I said earlier a couple of things right away. I think that we ought to be making it easy for Medicaid to fund mental health beds in places like Los Angeles in increments of more than 16 beds. So it's a cost effective thing for us to do. There, when I was, I will tell you, Mike, and resources are pivotal. Just today, I know this podcast will be airing later, but just today, LA was chosen among several jurisdictions in the country for additional federal intervention on homelessness. I'm going to be, if that hadn't happened already, it would have been one of my key things to try to move that forward. I'll tell you, there's something else I think that I want to do in Congress, and that is align districts across the United States on homelessness. When I was city attorney, after forming this group, being the co-founder of Prosecutors Against Gun Violence, I suggested to the former mayor and the former president of the council that we do the same thing on homelessness. This was when Paul Ryan was the speaker, because my thought was Ryan had just given a speech about Republicans focusing on poverty. And I was thinking homelessness is a common ground issue when it comes to poverty. No one wants homelessness to be pervasive in their jurisdictions. And I reached out to a former Congress member, Lucero Ballard, and she and her staff did something I asked for, which was to create a chart that revealed red cities in states and red states both where there are homeless issues. Think like Oklahoma City, places like that, with the thought that we should create a coalition of mayors from those cities who would descend on Capitol Hill and say, this is not just an issue in LA, whatever, it's an issue for us too. And there's still room to do that. On one level, LA has, I think, one in every five people experiencing homelessness in the United States is in our region. So yes, we are a concentration of that. But there are, as you know, homeless issues in jurisdictions across the country where there can be bipartisan leadership because they're Republican-controlled areas too. And I think we need to get past this notion that homelessness is just a coastal issue, east and west, and nothing in between, because when it's perceived that way, then you only have Democrats who care about it. And so I'm going to be focusing on resources for HUD, on rule changes at HHS, and I'm going to be focused also on trying to find a broader coalition to care about these issues. Because right now, not enough legislators on the Hill are focused on homelessness.
I want to ask about economic power, I guess, and get a sense of how you think about it. I'm a Bernie Sanders guy, and you know, Bernie's famous statement is that the economy is rigged in favor of the wealthy. I think Elizabeth Warren sort of thinks with a similar frame, and that pushes people who think that way to policies like Medicare for All and college debt forgiveness, paid family leave, public banking. How do you frame your understanding of what ails the economy?
Yeah, so on several different levels, I think. One, you know, I have a record in some of that. Recall that in the wake of some early reports about issues at Wells Fargo, I led the city attorney's office of L.A. to sue Wells Fargo, which became the catalyst for federal agencies to get involved later and change banking in many ways forever, because that system was, if rigged may not be quite the right word, that system was not in the customer's best interest. Let me put it that way for sure. It was in the interest of a big bank. So I have, you know, and having run a poverty law program for so many years, I have a strong sense of the depth of the inequity in our society. And, you know, the approach that I bring to grappling with that inequity is to focus on the jobs of the future, is to focus on getting resources directed to people who have nothing and get those resources to help people rebuild lives that otherwise have no hope. So let's be very concrete about what I mean by that. The digital divide, for example, caused these people behind all over Los Angeles and throughout major cities across the country. Remember when we went to in the pandemic, the chasm that existed between kids who had access to Wi-Fi and kids who didn't. This may seem like a prosaic issue. It's a very significant issue when we talk about the automation that's coming with AI. What happens, you know, Trump won the first time because a bunch of Midwestern 50-year-olds had no opportunities and no futures because they saw their jobs going away and they were looking for a place to have hope. So for me, the chasm that exists between rich and poor in our country cries out for elevating a middle class that in our city hardly exists. That's one of the center can't hold in a city with only rich and poor people. You got to have policies that address this. So I have supported single payer, for example, when it comes to healthcare. I've supported a number of policies we've already discussed that are designed to create some equity in a society that doesn't have it. When I was a lawyer in private practice, I won the ACLU's Education Advocacy Award for my role in a lawsuit where the basic theme was poor kids lack books, teachers, and quality facilities. And that was, I think, the most important education equity case in the last generation in California. I got in the middle of that case. You're going to see me getting in the middle of a lot of these issues here. And I'm purposely talking about concrete things because I think it's too easy for people to really relegate it to slogans. And I think that that's not where the world is. If you want to get things done, you got to understand the deficits. You're going to be focusing on education equity and changing the way we approach jobs and jobs of the future and the digital economy. You're going to see me focused on access to healthcare as I have been previously. And environmental justice is a huge piece of this as well. All these pieces kind of come together for me. So, you know, did I work with Liz? I remember being in Liz Warren's office in the middle of a Wells Fargo matter. So, you know, yeah, we can speak fluently about those issues together. But I can also be in a school in South LA and understand the issues associated with literacy. When I was on the city council, I created a program called Read LA because there was a huge gap in literacy, especially for monolingual Spanish speaking kids from households where mom and dad didn't speak English. So I, as a city council member, went to the school district and the community colleges and others and said, let's create a program to infuse teachers and training into public schools where kids are struggling to read. So the teacher-student ratio would go from 1 to 20 to 1 to 5 in grades K through 2. That's not a city council thing, but I did it. And so that's what people get with me, is someone who's trying to look beyond traditional roles because there's a need and you find a way to meet it. And on the economy, we desperately need to get beyond the labels and into the action.
Should the federal government be doing college debt forgiveness?
It's a good question. I think the answer is yes. But it may be that debt forgiveness, I know there's lawsuits pending about this now. Do I think that debt forgiveness should be done irrespective of ability to pay? I have some questions about that because we have scarce resources. It's not that I think that college debt is good for anybody, but I do think that when you have $1, you got to be deciding who's going to get access to that dollar. And I do have some concerns about situations where kids who have the ability to repay over time, for example, are not be the target of that scarce expenditure of very, very sparse federal dollars. I will say, by the way, debt forgiveness has many dimensions to it. And one that I never hear talked about is this. Kids who are saddled with debt choose jobs that are designed to enable them to repay the debt. When I'm a big national service fan, for example, we got to be able to, you know, think about who can afford to have a voluntary internship, for example. You know, that's the lens through which I view some of these issues. You want to be able to create opportunities for all kids and for people to take jobs where they're not worried about money as much as they're worried about making the world better for somebody else. And I'm serious about it. You know, after 9/11, I did some radio commentaries on public radio here. And one of the things I talked about is the importance of seizing a moment when American flags were everywhere. There was this great feeling of patriotism. Let's make that the moment to create a muscular national service program, not just military service, but service, you know, voluntary teaching or helping kids on the streets of a city who are impoverished and need food to eat. I do want to see the federal government move to, you know, AmeriCorps is the expression of that. But I think it's been not nearly as popular as it should be. So anyway, I think, again, all these issues have facets that aren't often discussed. You know, gun violence has an issue of trauma that affects kids' brains. Debt forgiveness has an impact on what kind of jobs kids can afford to take and what that does to the civic infrastructure of our nation. We should be a very, very aspirational society where people are lifted up and told the best aspect of who you can be is to help somebody else.
Another thing that causes people a lot of trauma that impacts the rest of their life is an eviction. During the pandemic, the federal government had a number of renter protections in place that have now been removed because of the end of the pandemic. Are there any of them that you'd be in favor of reinstating?
Well, let's go back in time for a second, give you a sense of where I'm coming from. So when the pandemic first started, I called Maxine Waters, who at that point was the chair of the Committee on Banking and Housing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I said to her, it's clear in this pandemic that it's not the tenant's fault that she lost her job. And it's clear that it's not the landlord's fault that the tenant lost their job and can't pay. And we as a city have to balance our budget. The state has to balance our budget. You do not. And this is one of the moments when the federal government is uniquely situated to step in, and there should be $150 billion devoted to making tenants and landlords whole. Now, I am not saying it was because of my phone call that that happened, but I did that at a very early stage because I could see that role for the federal government to play. And again, I felt it was important to communicate that to Congressmember Waters. The protections, we can't afford to sustain some of those protections for a long period of time anymore. And that's a huge issue for us. And on the council, you confronted the question, when does the eviction moratorium end? And it's a very difficult thing. But other antidotes can come into play. So, for example, it is not by no means God's gift to resolutions here, but I have been a supporter, as you know, for years of a right to counsel for people. Mm-hmm. Including a right to counsel who are facing eviction. As a member of the state legislature in a recession when no new programs were getting started, I wrote a bill called the Sergeant Shriver Civil Counsel Act that created a whole new way for the state to fund new legal services defense for people in the eviction and custody proceedings. So that is something that I think we should be focused on. I also think, though, that some of the as we think about the pandemic, we have learned some lessons. And one of the lessons we've learned is that people are looking for meaning in their lives right now. This is a little bit of a field from your question, but I do want to say, you know, restaurants can't find workers now at $20 an hour. There are a number of jobs, home health care, those kinds of industries are struggling to get people for $20, $25, $30 an hour because people are often reevaluating what matters to them most. And I think this is an opportunity for the country to try to redefine what work is, and the federal government can have a role to play in that too, with pilot projects designed to test new ways for us to be. So I don't have an easy prescription for an array of federal spending approaches to grapple with the post-pandemic world. I am concerned about evictions. I'm concerned about what happens when people have no place else to go. I think the jury is out as to the degree to which landlords are going to do what we all feared, which is mass evictions. We haven't seen mass evictions yet, but I'm concerned about the fact that that chasm in the economy that preceded the pandemic, that continues to persist, and that should be a target of federal spending.
Immigration reform. Do you agree or disagree with the Biden immigration policies?
That's a pretty broad question. Let's take them apart a little bit. So, you know, I am among those who thinks that we desperately need a pathway to citizenship. I mean, here are the ingredients that I see in immigration reform. A path, you know, we have 11, 12 million people here who for years, for decades, we've been saying they aren't going anywhere. They are working and are productive members of our society. Give them a pathway to citizenship. I strongly agree with that. The DACA kids are the least common denominator for immigration reform because there are people on both sides of the aisle who support perpetuating DACA. There's a program called Temporary Protective Status for other immigrants. That's a little bit, it's less known by many of our listeners, I think, but there are people from other countries, think Haiti, among others, for example, who are here because of conditions in their home countries. I want to see us work on those issues. I cannot imagine an equation on Capitol Hill other than having more border protections and at the same time, pathway to citizenship plus DACA plus TPS plus a few other things. And I would vote for a formula like that, not because I would value every aspect of the outcome, but because we cannot go on like this. We have to bring 11, 12 million people out of the shadows. Those DACA kids can't be living under the shadow of potentially having to be deported from this country. People here on under TPS live every day wondering if we're going to be able to stay in a nation that is now their own. We need to take steps right now. And so I think some formula needs to happen. Now, if you're asking me, you know, about some of the increased restrictions on the border, I'm not sure yet. I mean, I'm troubled by some of the approaches being taken by the administration now. But I also recognize that the crisis at the border in the day that we're talking today has subsided a little bit from what people anticipated it would be. But look, we can't go back to kids in cages. A kid just died in Border Patrol custody just a couple of days ago. That's horrific.
Police brutality. What steps should Congress be taking?
It's a great question because, as you know, most of the reforms sought at a federal level already exist in Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so. You know, bans on chokeholds, for example, and other steps that are being sought nationally should happen nationally. They're already part of our course of conduct here in LA now. I think that, you know, it's interesting as I've gone throughout the city, there's not a neighborhood in the city to which I have been, and I've been to every one of them, where people didn't say, I would like to see more police. The difference that I hear is, for example, I was at a park in South Los Angeles talking to folks, and I heard, I want more police here. I just don't want to be profiled. Well, you know what? Damn right. When I was on the city council, I went to a hearing in the basement of the First AME Church and heard person after person be uptight about racial profiling. So I put into the consent decree that the city had with the federal government provisions on racial profiling. So yeah, I think you don't do racial profiling. You don't have, you know, you have the choices that have been that so horrific around the nation. And you don't allow the musical chairs of officers who've been fired from departments for use of force violations to be then rehired in other jurisdictions without them knowing about that. A national registry of who those people are is very important. There are a lot of reforms that I think are important. But I also think that it's essential for us to be able to find a model of law enforcement where everybody thinks, hey, law enforcement is here to help us. And that means some of the things that have been happening here, I've been a long advocate for example, taking away from police interventions of mental health incidents where there isn't an act of violence on the table at that moment. The city now is experimenting with taking some traffic interventions away from police. Mm-hmm. Nationally, these kinds of moves, I think, are important because they have the potential for de-escalating violent confrontation.
In Sacramento, they're about to start having a pretty big conversation about reparations. Is that a conversation you think that the federal government should be having?
It's a good question. And of course, Mike, as you know, reparations is an umbrella term that can mean many things to many people. For some people, the conversation means checks, like Japanese American families received after Reagan apologized for the internment. For others, it means infusing resources into communities that are historically disadvantaged. For some, it means providing, for example, making up for the fact that here in our city, in Los Angeles, as you know, I served with Rita Walters on the city council when you were a staff member. Rita couldn't buy an African-American, people don't know this because your podcast, your listeners don't know who she is. Rita was a pioneer in L.A. in African-American politics. She was a member of the city council who was black and couldn't buy a house in the Valley because her family was precluded from doing that. So there is a legacy that, as you know, has precluded generational wealth from being transmitted from one generation to another. So are there antidotes that are systemic? I think there are some important system things to be taken into account. I'm not sure yet how I feel about checks to people. Yeah. I'm not sure that's the right approach. But I think irrespective of the reparations conversation that is underway right now, the investments that I'm talking about should be happening, in my view.
Two quick questions and then a close. Are there any industries or sources of donations that you are refusing during the campaign?
Well, first of all, this is easy pickings for me because let's be real, I'm not going to get offered donations from the places that I'm going to talk about. But because of my stances on the environment, I'm not going to get oil and fossil fuel donations, but I would reject them if they were offered to me. Because of my stances on gun violence, I'm not going to get money from the gun industry, but of course I would reject that money. I suppose there are other industries that I could think of in the same category. But, you know, that should not inspire your listeners to support me because of that, because it's not an act of courage. I'm not going to get offered those donations because I have such strong views on this array of issues because of my record as a progressive leader. So, those are examples. Pharmaceutical industry is not giving me money either, you know. banking industry, you know.
Yep.
Go ahead.
And have you thought about which caucuses you would join in Congress?
A little bit. I thought about what committees I want to serve on, which I think is the most important issue for a new member.
Yep.
And parenthetically, I mentioned banking and housing, energy and commerce, because of the importance I attach to the climate crisis that we have and the confluence of economic development and responding to that crisis. As you know, I chaired the budget process in the city. And any listener who thinks that chairing the budget is a boring job because a bunch of numbers, being in charge of the budget means that you are the architect of the most important priorities substantively in the jurisdiction in which you're in. So ways and means and appropriations, you know, spending and how you give out money are key committees for me to look at. And by the way, appropriations I meant oversight. When I was in Sacramento, when I was asked to be the majority leader for policy, one of the jobs I was asked to take on was to teach members how to conduct oversight hearings. Mm. That is not a boring thing. Oversight may sound that way. What that means is there is a program on homelessness in Los Angeles. Is it working or not? You haul the people in charge of it and grill them about why and find prescriptions to do better. There is an environmental problem in this community. Who's doing anything about it? That's an oversight hearing. Oversight hearings are the catalyst for major change. So I thought very hard about those roles that I want to play. I think I will be a member of the Progressive Caucus. I'm not sure what other caucuses I will join. But the issue is I'm going to decide caucus membership based on one criterion, and that is, by doing this, am I adding value to my mission here, which is to make a mark on the issues we've discussed? If I think there's value to be added, yeah. But I won't have time to spend on things that will not add value, because a member of Congress doesn't do a good job if they do a little bit in 100 areas. That person is not an impact player. That person's a vote.
Yep.
So I'm going to be focused on priorities.
Final question is about hope and about optimism. It's really hard for a lot of people to find hope and optimism for our country or for our political system. We've got false claims of rigged elections, an insurrection, civil rights are being stripped away, elected representatives are being denied the right to speak in their chambers in some states, gun violence, climate change. It's really hard for a lot of people to see how we get out of here. You're running for office, so obviously you have a sense of optimism and hope for the future, or you wouldn't be doing it. What gives you hope? What gives you a sense of optimism?
You know, I think about that almost every day. And you're right. No, the reason to choose to be in public service is at the end of the day, because you are hopeful that you can make a difference in making the world better. And you believe that the system you're entering has the potential to bring that change. Otherwise, why do this? So what makes me hopeful? A bunch of things, actually. I think there is a real hunger in our nation for optimistic, hopeful, aspirational, positive leadership. And the people who feel that way are the majority in our country. And I think tapping into that and bringing out the best in people is the best of what politics is. I think that there is, even in the darkness that you describe, there is another side to these things that could lead to hope. I mentioned the climate crisis is moving faster than anybody anticipated. Well, on the other side of that horrific revelation is the fact that that means that people are paying attention and can be catalyzed to get stuff done. You know, on homelessness in Los Angeles, it's horrible that it's everywhere. But because it touches everybody, no one can ignore it. Mm-hmm. And everybody can say they have some skin in the game. So I am optimistic about the fact that people want better. No one is happy now. They want to transcend this. And I have seen, and you have seen in your public service career, so many people who want to give of themselves. And that makes me very optimistic. And, you know, I get concerned when there are politicians who try to get people to retreat into their own selves and back off and disengage. And one of the things I did when I was in the state legislature, in the face of Republican voter suppression efforts across the United States, I purposely then chose to write California's same-day voter registration law. And I did that because I think that young people are potentially interested in being part of these solutions and aren't. They're scared to death about things large and small, the climate, and they can't afford a house in Los Angeles, right? Both those things are true. And, you know, tapping into that concern, but also there's energy and enthusiasm there. There's intellect, there's horsepower. And I just think, because I've seen it and I've been involved in doing it, that we can unlock the positive side of this in people if we choose to be inspiring leaders and not divisive leaders. If we choose to say that we're better when we lift each other up. And, you know, you asked me more than once about why I chose to be so deeply involved in LGBTQ issues. And because I'm straight, right? And people say, you know, why? And the answer is partly because I had brothers who are gay and I understood their experiences. But it's also because I think that the role of a leader is to identify causes and people who are being left behind for some reason or other, and to say, let's together, not for you, let's do it together as a team, let's change lives. And I think there are a lot of people who feel that way. So yeah, I get the cynicism and the unhappiness and the tumultuousness, because I feel all those things sometimes too. I just choose, and part of this is having lived through that car accident, I have to say, I just choose to believe that there is something better around the corner. Because that, Mike, that's the last thing I'll say. That's a choice. It's a choice to be cynical and dispirited and to be depressed. It's also a choice to say, that's not how I'm going to live the rest of my life. And I think politics, at its best, takes advantage of that choice and says to people, there's something better ahead. Join us. Be part of this. That's what I think.
Mike Feuer, thanks for joining me on What's Next Los Angeles.
Thank you, Mike. Really appreciate it. Good to see you. Take care.